After. The past hangs between them as Will makes supper, chopping aubergine and chorizo, in a silence made somehow more oppressive by the chatter of the Radio 4 announcer. Hannah tries and fails to think what to say, and in the end she retreats to the living room where she pulls out her laptop and opens her emails. She deleted the Gmail app from her phone in a panic after her mother's call came through, not wanting to be ambushed by notification pings on her walk home. And now she's more than a little afraid of what will be waiting for her, but she knows that leaving it would be worse. At bedtime, with nothing else to distract her, she will lie there wondering what's lurking in her inbox, until eventually she'll crack and log back in on her phone. And then, whatever she finds, whatever new revelation, dangled lead, or fresh attempt to manipulate her into responding, will set her pulse spiking and her adrenaline pumping, driving the possibility of sleep so far away that she will be awake all night, nauseous with apprehension, refreshing and refreshing, and Googling April's name in a kind of sick terror. She knows that's how it will go down, because it's what happened before. Daily, more than daily messages in the first few months and years after April's death. A constant, numbing flood of beseeching, badgering, beleaguering requests that left her shocked and bruised by the national obsession that April's death had triggered. As the court case concluded, the requests slowed. First, they came weekly, and then, as she and Will managed to slip beneath the surface of everyday life, camouflaging themselves in the reassuringly boring minutiae of accountancy courses, house buying, money worries, and all the other mundane clutter of daily existence, they became more and more sporadic. Now she is contacted only rarely and almost never by phone, not since they got rid of the landline and Hannah changed her mobile number. It still happens, though, every time John Neville's name rears up in the press, every time there's an appeal by Neville's legal team, or someone publishes a book, or a new podcast is launched. And it's taken this long for her to learn avoidance is not the way to deal with it. No, it's better to do it now, get it out of the way, allow herself to calm down before bed. But, to her surprise and relief, there are only three unread emails. One is from her mum, sent earlier this afternoon with the subject line, "Call me." It precedes their phone call, so she deletes it. The second is just an overdue notice from the library and she marks it unread. The third is from an email address she doesn't recognise with the subject header, "A question." Her heart rate is already accelerating even before she has clicked it, and the first line confirms her fears. "Dear Hannah, we've never met, but allow me to introduce myself. My name is Geraint Williams, and I'm a reporter with the Daily..." It's enough. She doesn't need to read any more. She takes off her glasses, letting the screen go fuzzy and unreadable, then clicks, "Move to requests," and watches the email disappear. Afterwards, she sits there holding her glasses in one hand and her phone in the other, staring at the blank screen. Her fingers are suddenly ice cold, and she pulls her jumper down over her hands to try to warm them. She can feel her pulse running sickeningly fast and shallow, and she wonders, in a kind of detached way, what the stress is doing to the baby. They're very tough. She hears her mother's voice in her head, reassuringly robust. "Women give birth in war zones, for goodness sake." "Are you okay?" The voice comes from behind her and she jumps, even as her conscious brain is registering Will's presence. He squeezes into the armchair beside her, puts his arms around her, and she shifts and settles into his lap.
"I'm sorry," he says quietly. "I didn't mean to go all stiff upper lip on you. I needed to process it a bit."
She leans into his chest, feeling the muscles in his arms flex as he wraps himself around her. There's something about his strength and heft that's inexpressibly reassuring, in a kind of unreasoning way. It shouldn't matter that Will is taller and broader and stronger than she is. She had gone far beyond fearing John Neville as a physical threat, even before her mother's call. But somehow, it does matter. And his physical presence is more comforting than any number of soothing words. She curls into him, her forehead on his chest, feeling his breath on her parting and the heat of him, warming her still frozen fingers. As if reading her thoughts, he speaks.
"God, your hands are like ice. Come here."
He takes them in his and puts them firmly up under his shirt, shuddering for a moment as her cold fingers connect with the warm, naked skin over his ribs, but then relaxing into her touch as the first chill subsides. "How are you? Always so hot," she manages with a shaky laugh, and he rests his chin on the top of her head, stroking her hair with one hand.
"I don't know. Years of shit central heating at Cannes, maybe." "Oh, sweetheart, I'm really sorry this had to come now. I know how hard this is for you."
She nods, pressing her forehead to his collarbone, staring into the warm darkness of the hollow between their bodies. He knows. Perhaps he is the only person who really does, who understands the complicated maelstrom of feelings Neville's death has stirred up. Because on the surface, this should be good news. John Neville is gone, forever. And long term, it probably is for the best. But short term, this is going to mean a flurry of interest, a shattering of their hard-won illusion of normalcy, just when she and Will should be concentrating on the new life they are bringing into the world, not thinking about the one they both saw snuffed out. She remembers the days and months after April's death, that searing, relentless searchlight of media obsession. The feeling that something appalling had happened and all she wanted was to hide in the shadows and rock back and forth as she tried to come to terms with what she had seen. But wherever she ran, whatever she did, that searchlight kept seeking her out. "Miss Jones, a quick comment, please. Hannah, could we have an interview? 5 minutes, I promise." For 10 long years, ever since the trial, in fact, she's been hiding from that spotlight. For 10 years, April's death has been the first thing she thinks about when she wakes up and the last thing at night. And she knows it's been that way for Will, too. They have spent the whole of their relationship with the shadow of April's memory looming over them. But these last few months, with the baby and everything else, she has allowed herself, not to forget, exactly, because she could never do that, but to feel like April's death was no longer the defining part of her life. And although she and Will have never discussed it in so many words, she's pretty sure it's been the same for him. Now, with Neville's death and the inevitable media flurry, it will be back to changing their numbers and screening their messages. Hannah will find herself looking twice at customers coming into the bookshop, At Carter and Price, the accountancy firm where Will is a junior partner, the new receptionist will be told what happened, instructed to ask a few more questions before routing calls and setting up appointments. It's been hard for him too. Harder in some ways, though he would never say so. But it's no coincidence that he followed her here, to Scotland, a country with its own legal system, its own newspapers, a place almost as far away from Oxford as it was possible to get without leaving the UK altogether. She remembers the grey September day 8 years ago when he walked into the bookshop. She was helping a customer choose a birthday present, debating the merits of the new Michael Palin versus the latest Bill Bryson. Something, a noise or a movement behind her, had made Hannah turn, and there he was. For a moment she had lost the power of speech. She had simply stood there, the customer rattling happily on about Rick Stein, while Hannah's heart beat and beat and beat with a kind of fierce joy. 3 months later, they moved in together. 2 years later, they were married. It's strange. Will is the best thing that ever happened to her, and yet they are bound together by the worst events of her life. It shouldn't work, but it does. She would not have survived this without him. She knows that. Now she lifts her head, looks him in the face, and runs her fingers down his cheek, trying to read his own feelings beneath his concern for her. Are you okay?
I'm fine, he says reflexively, and then, I mean, not fine, exactly.
He's struggling, she can see that. It's been a bone of contention their whole relationship, his tendency to shut himself away from her, to pretend everything is fine just when he's closest to falling apart. The worse things are, the more stressed he is at work, the more worried he is about money, the less he says. Talk to me. It's been her cry for almost 10 years. And he's still figuring out how to deal with the vulnerability of opening himself up when his entire childhood was about not showing weakness.
I'm okay, he says at last. Or I will be, when I've had time to process the news. But I've not had to deal with it in the same way you did. I didn't see.
He stops, begins again.
I haven't had to go through everything you did.
She nods, because it's true. Yes, Will was there, and yes, April meant just as much to him, maybe even more. But he didn't see what Hannah saw that night. And he didn't have to spend the next weeks, months, even years going over and over and over what happened. First with the police, then with the prosecution lawyers, and finally in court, in the witness box. But it didn't stop, even after the conviction, because the fact is that the case against John Neville rested on her evidence. And that's something no one has ever allowed her to forget. Will is speaking again now, his voice sounding softer and deeper than usual, with her head resting on his chest.
Maybe, I mean, maybe in a way, this is for the best.
Hannah doesn't speak at first.
Why now, is what she's thinking. Why now, when they should be so happy?
So wrapped up in each other and in the baby they have made. She shouldn't have to be dealing with retrospectives and newscast specials at all, but especially not now. But then she thinks of the years stretching out ahead of them, filled with a never-ending parade of newspaper articles and appeals and requests for comment, and she knows Will is right. And yet, why doesn't this feel right?
The BBC said he was preparing another appeal, she says.
Appeal. The word feels sick with dread in her mouth.
I don't think I could have taken that. I just don't want all the renewed interest. But you're right. When this is over... She stops, almost too fearful to voice it.
Instead, it's Will who says the words, his voice firm as he tightens his arm around her.
When this is over, it'll really, finally be over.
And for the first time, Hannah allows herself to believe that it might be true.
Before. Take it off! Take it off!
April chanted, flashing a meaningful look around the rest of the group to get them to join in. Hannah looked down at herself and then at the cards in her hand. It had been April's idea to play strip poker, and at first Hannah had felt fairly confident. She was actually a pretty good poker player, and in any case she was wearing several layers, if you counted accessories. But whether it was bad luck or the amount of champagne she had drunk, she had been losing for several hands now, and she was down to removing either her jeans or her top. She tried to remember whether she had shaved her legs in the shower that morning and couldn't. It would have to be her top. The thought gave her a weird feeling. Halfway between a sickening thrill of nerves and a flutter of excitement. Was she really going to do this? Was she going to strip down to her bra in front of five people she'd only met that day?
Take it off!
Ryan joined in, and then Emily. Hannah shot a look around the circle at the laughing, drunken faces. Only Hugh looked as uncomfortable as she felt. In fact, he had tried to get out of playing, making an excuse about the time and the fact that he was tired. April had been having none of it, however.
Shut up, Hugh. Nobody cares. You're playing, and that's that, she had said.
And Hugh, to Hannah's surprise, had sat back down, tension and anger emanating from every muscle. Now he was hunched miserably between Will and Ryan, his arms wrapped self-consciously around his naked, bony ribs. And the only reason he was down to his jeans and not his underpants was because April had graciously allowed him to count each sock as a separate garment. Hannah again cursed the fact that she'd been wearing sandals.
Hey, Will said. He leaned forwards, his black hair falling into his eyes in a way that made something deep inside Hannah twist with desire.
He was bare-chested, his torso lean and sculpted in a way so unlike Hugh's that they might have been different species. She became aware that she was staring and forced her gaze up to his face. He was smiling, but not in a mocking way.
Hey, don't let them bully you.
Oh, bloody hell, Hannah said, but now she was laughing too, partly at herself, partly out of disbelief that she was really going to do this. But she was going to do it. Deep down, she knew it. She could storm out, but only back to her own room, right next door to where they were all drinking. She would be able to hear their mocking laughter and the music from April's iPod through the wall. And she couldn't begin her 3 years at Pelham by establishing herself as a sore loser with no sense of fun. But it wasn't just that. A part of her wanted this. She wanted to be as cool and
daring and sexy as April, who sprawled across the circle from her with a wicked glint. She wanted to be brash, sardonic Emily sitting opposite, totally unfazed by the fact that she had lost her jumper, skirt, belt and shoes, was down to a thigh-skimming shirt and not much else. She wanted to be one of these people. She was one of these people, so she was just going to have to act like it.
"Take it off," April called again,
and with a sick feeling like she was jumping off a cliff, Hannah stood up, pulled off her top, and did an ironic twirl as the others whooped and applauded. Her cheeks were scarlet, her stomach was fluttering, and she wasn't sure whether to laugh or scowl, so she did both, crossing her arms defiantly over her chest as she took her place in the circle. She kept her gaze determinedly away from Will. Ryan gave a long, piercing wolf whistle and flung his arm around Emily, who was sitting next to him.
"Here you go,"
he said, holding out the joint they'd been passing around.
"You've earned it."
"She doesn't want that soggy, disgusting thing," April said.
Her eyes were wide and bright with laughter, and her face was as flushed as Hannah's, although not with embarrassment. She herself was down to a pleated satin skirt and her bra, but clearly not one that had been bought in a 5-pack from M&S. It was a push-up turquoise silk, embroidered with tiny scarlet and pink butterflies that made her tan skin glow.
"Have a drink, darling."
She held out the bottle. It was champagne produced from a seemingly inexhaustible supply in a mini-fridge that certainly wasn't standard college equipment. The label was jewelled and art deco, and although Hannah knew nothing about champagne, she strongly suspected it must have been expensive. But it had been passed around the group for too long, and now it was warm and acid in her mouth, the flavour not improved by swigging directly from the bottle, as there were not enough glasses. Hannah shuddered, but she took a long gulp, feeling the fuzzy warmth of the alcohol filtering into her blood, and then she grinned and passed the bottle back to April.
"Come on, Hugh," April drawled. "You're up."
Hugh nodded and began to deal. With the next hand, April lost her skirt, taking it off with a shimmying strip-tease panache that revealed long tanned legs and a very small turquoise thong. Will lost his jeans, but the following round, Hannah realised with a sinking feeling that she was about to lose again. The hand played out with agonising slowness, but at the end of it, her prediction proved correct, and her 2-4s lost comprehensively. As she scrambled out of her jeans, she ran a surreptitious hand over her calves and was relieved to find them fairly smooth. In the dim light, no one would be able to see any stubble. Still, when she sat back down, she folded her legs beneath herself just in case. She felt sick with nerves and excitement. She could not afford to lose again. Stripping to underwear was one thing. It wasn't that different from going swimming in the end, but actually getting properly naked? Could she really do this? From the nervous frisson in the air, she could tell she wasn't the only person having doubts. Hugh had his knees to his chest, as if trying to hide his skinny frame, and was looking, frankly, mortified. Emily was chewing her lip, and Will, as if pulled by a magnet, her eyes flicked once again to Will. But this time, he was already looking at her. Their eyes met with a jolt that sent a little electric prickle running over Hannah's skin. Then she tore her gaze away, her cheeks flushed so hot that she was sure someone would notice.
April dealt out the next hand, going around the circle with tantalizing slowness, her eyes wide and dark with excitement. Some people took the cards one at a time. Hannah preferred not to. They were playing straight poker, just a simple five-card deal with no flop, and in that scenario, it was hard not to give away what you were hoping for when you were waiting for the cards as they were dealt. Hugh was picking up his cards one by one, and from his body language it was obvious that he didn't have a good hand. Emily was harder to read. She picked up the cards singly, tucking them into her hand with a little double tap on each one. Ryan looked smug. There was no other word for it. And as for Will... But here she was stumped. Will, like her, had left his cards on the floor. April laid out the fifth card in each hand, and as the last one went down, Hannah scooped up the whole lot and surveyed them. Almost immediately her stomach dropped, though she tried to keep her face bland and blank. A pair of threes, which was about as weak as it got.
"I'm out," Hugh said.
He threw in his hand and took off his jeans. The forfeit for folding was one piece of clothing, and he clearly didn't want to risk anyone raising the stakes while he still had a garment to lose. When he sat back down, his cheeks were scarlet, and Hannah shot him a sympathetic look. April was dealer, so was out of the running.
"I bet one garment," Emily said.
She was still wearing her top and bra, and she tapped her cards on the floor, looking more than a little smug.
"One garment," Will said, and gave a grin that made Hannah's stomach flutter.
He only had one garment to lose, so there was no possibility of him raising the stakes.
"Hannah?"
"One," Hannah said, but her mouth was thick and dry, and she had to take a gulp of champagne before repeating, more clearly,
"One garment."
There was no point in folding. If she did, she would have to take off her bra, and the rules were that the person with the weakest hand had to strip. Maybe Will was bluffing.
"Ryan?"
"Two,"
Ryan said wickedly, looking at Emily's shirt and his own jeans, and then he laughed.
"Just kidding. One garment."
"Okay," April said. "Let's see him, folks. Emily?"
"Three of a kind," Emily said.
She laid them out with a kind of laconic triumph. Three fives. It was a good hand. Better than Hannah's.
"Beat that," she said to Ryan.
"Well, I hate to disappoint, but..."
"Flush,"
Ryan said. He gave Emily a flashing grin and laid out five diamonds.
"You fucker,"
Emily said equably. But she didn't look too worried. In strip poker, it didn't really matter who won. What mattered was who lost. Only the loser would have to strip. And three fives was still a pretty good hand, particularly given she still had her top to lose. It was down to Hannah and Will. Hannah looked across the circle at him. He was leaning back against the legs of the armchair, long bare legs stretched out across the circle, his arms folded across his naked chest. He was smiling, and she knew that he must have a good hand, and that he could see the desperation in her eyes. She felt her heart thumping in her chest so hard that when she looked down at her hand, she could actually see the lace trim of her bra trembling. Could she do it? Was she really going to get naked in front of this room of complete strangers?
"Hannah,"
April said, with that purring little note in her voice. Hannah swallowed. She put down one three, then another. And then Will let his cards drop face down.
"I'm out,"
he said with a wry smile.
I guess I'll be removing these.
He looked down at his boxers, his expression comically dismayed. You could have heard a pin drop.
Okay.
It was Emily who stood up, breaking the tension.
Well, that's quite enough of that as far as I'm concerned. I have no desire to see anyone's meat and two veg.
She stood up, stretching unselfconsciously, so that her shirt rode up, exposing an unexpected flash of Bart Simpson knickers, and then reached for her leather miniskirt.
What?
April said, sounding aggrieved.
You must be joking. It's barely even midnight.
It's 2 a.m.,
Emily said, waving her phone.
And I want to be conscious for the master's induction speech tomorrow. Yeah,
Ryan stood up too and pulled his football shirt on over his head.
I'm with her. Want to walk me back to clothes?
He asked Emily, who shrugged but followed him to the door.
Ugh, you're such party poopers,
April grumbled. But she seemed to accept defeat and began gathering up the cards as Hugh started hunting around for his socks and phone.
I guess I'll call it a day too, Hannah said rather diffidently.
She stood up and reached for her top, holding it against herself like a protective shield.
Night, everyone.
April didn't respond. She just shrugged rather sulkily. It was Will who looked up.
Night, Hannah. Yes, good night, Hannah,
Hugh said rather awkwardly.
And thank you, April. I had a great time.
April snorted at that.
Like fuck you did. You looked like I was pulling out your nipple hairs one by one.
Hugh flushed as if he didn't quite know what to say.
Are you coming, Will?
He asked after a short pause.
In a sec,
Will said. He was buckling his jeans.
You head over. I won't be long.
Night, April, Hannah said. There was a slightly pleading note in her voice, which she instantly despised, but did not know how to change.
She picked up the cards nearest her and held them out. April took them.
Night,
she said rather crossly, shoving them into the pack, and Hannah turned and walked into her room. As her bedroom door closed behind her, Hannah allowed herself a shuddering sigh of relief, thankful that she hadn't had to be the one to take a stand and incur April's wrath, and equally grateful that Emily had stepped in before someone lost their last layer.
Now, as she stood there, her head spinning a little from the champagne she had drunk, she had the strangest feeling. Almost as if she were surveying herself from a distance, marvelling at the fact that she, Hannah Jones, had found herself surrounded by these exotic, clever, glamorous creatures. For a moment, she had a piercing flashback to Dodsworth,
to the kids who hung around the off-licence in the town square, trying to buy cider with fake IDs and smoking Marlboro Lights behind the bus station. Maybe there were kids at their school who drank champagne and played strip poker, but if they existed, they weren't part of the crowd Hannah hung around with. She had never been one of the girls who went to parties, applied mascara in the school bathroom, or had their boyfriends pick them up at the end of the day in a car. The closest Hannah had come to breaking the rules was deliberately failing to return a school library book she needed for her exams. And now, here she was, at one of the most sought-after colleges in Oxford, surrounded by people she would barely have had the courage to say hello to, were it not for her luck in finding April. As she stood there, peeling off her underwear and shoving her arms into the kimono she used as a makeshift dressing gown, she felt a sudden wash of, not gratitude, exactly, but a kind of wonder at the miracle of what had just happened. She was here, at Oxford, sharing a room with a girl so infinitely cool and glamorous that she might have stepped out of the pages of a magazine. She, Hannah, could reinvent herself here. Okay, she wasn't as spiky or witty as Emily or as cheeky and sarcastic as Ryan, but she could be someone else, someone new. Maybe, and here she swallowed, a shiver of longing running across her bare skin beneath the kimono, maybe she could even be a girl that someone like Will would look twice at. Will. Will, who had sat across the circle from her, watching her with that slow, lazy smile. Will, who had stayed back at the end of the night when he could have returned to Clothes with his friend Hugh. Will, who... And then Hannah paused, with a sudden, clear picture of the card she had picked up at the end of the evening. She had turned them face up as she passed them to April, and now she realized something. The cards weren't her hand. There had been five of them, a single ten, and four queens, four of a kind. Not just a good hand, but the winning one. Not her hand, but Will's. Hannah took a step towards the door and stopped, her hand on the knob, trying to figure it out. Will had saved her. He had taken the hit himself rather than force her to take off her clothes. But why? Was he just being nice? Was it pity for her obvious desperation? Or was it? She remembered his eyes meeting hers, the little prickle that had passed between them. Was it something more? Whichever it was, it might not be too late to find out. Will had hung back, and perhaps he had done so for a reason. Hannah licked her lips, pushed her long hair behind her ears. The mirror on the back of the door showed a girl with a wide, full mouth, huge dark eyes dilated with terror, cheeks flushed with excitement. "Please don't be gone," she whispered under her breath. "Please don't be gone." Her stomach was knotting with a mixture of nerves and desire. But she'd had enough champagne to know that she could do this. And that glance across the circle had meant something. She knew it. She had felt something travel between them in that moment. The acknowledgement of an attraction so strong, it had to be mutual, didn't it? She tightened the belt of her gown, then turned the handle and counted to three. "Please don't be gone." The door opened. He wasn't gone. He was standing on the far side of the room, still shirtless, but he didn't turn as Hannah's door opened. He and April were locked in each other's arms. Neither of them seemed to notice Hannah standing frozen in the doorway. Instead, she watched as April led Will backwards across the little room, her lips against his, one hand in his hair, the other at his belt. At her bedroom door, she paused, groped behind her for the handle, twisting it blindly, and then the latch gave, and the pair of them stumbled through the open doorway and into the darkness of April's room. Then the door closed behind them, and Hannah was left alone. After. When Hannah wakes up, it's with the feeling that something is different. It's not the fact that the bed is empty, that happens every Wednesday, Hannah's day off in lieu of working Saturdays in the shop. On Wednesday,
Will puts his phone under his pillow so that his alarm doesn't disturb her and tiptoes out of bed before she wakes. It's not just the fact that she's pregnant and the strange feelings that go with that, the odd morning stiffness, the heaviness in her body, the feeling of queasiness that she has never quite got under control, in spite of what the books say about when it's supposed to end. No, it's something else. She knows that, even in the dazed aftermath of sleep, before the events of yesterday come rushing back to her. Now she lies there, staring at the ceiling, trying to work out how she feels. Wednesdays are usually a treat, a chance to catch up on errands, call into town, or, increasingly as her pregnancy has progressed, just spend the day lolling around their sunny Muse flat, doing nothing, in a kind of lazy trance. But today, the thought of sitting by herself in the empty flat, Will at work, nothing but the news and the yawning Google search bar to distract her, is intolerable. It's not that there isn't stuff she could be doing. She could be researching prams or building the flat-pack cot that has been sitting propped in the corner of their bedroom for the last 6 weeks. But somehow, she can't bring herself to slit open the cardboard boxes. It feels like tempting fate. A presumptuous taking for granted of a future she has learned the hard way not to rely on. But she can't lie there thinking like that. Instead, she gets up, pulls on her dressing gown, and goes through to the kitchen, rubbing the sleep from the corners of her eyes as she makes the one coffee she allows herself these days. Will has left the radio on, as he often does when running out to catch an early meeting. She hasn't really been paying attention, but now something the newscaster is saying snags at her, and she leans across the counter to turn up the volume.
Has died in prison, aged 63. Neville, who was convicted in 2012 of the killing of Oxford University student April Clark Cliveden,
Hannah's hand shoots for the off button, cursing her own stupidity, but it's too late. As the room falls silent, she finds her hand is shaking. She can't stay here. She has to get out. It's drizzling in the park, but the rain provides a kind of comforting cocoon as she walks slowly down the leafy avenue in her Mac. When she and Will moved into Stockbridge a few years ago, it was the hip, artistic district of Edinburgh, still relatively affordable compared to Newtown, if anything in central Edinburgh could really be called affordable. But the area has grown up with them, its village vibe luring in young families alongside the bars and coffee shops. And now the streets are filled with bumps and buggies, or it seems that way to Hannah. Maybe it's just her own bump, making her see the world with different eyes. There are children in the park today, despite the weather, stomping about in wellies or clambering across dripping rope bridges while their resigned parents and carers huddle under the cover of the trees, doing their supervision from a distance. Hannah comes to a halt under the shelter of a big yew, watching them when her phone goes. She pulls it out of her pocket, wipes the mist from her glasses, and glances cautiously at the caller ID. But it's okay. She picks up. Hi, Mum.
Hello, love. Is it your day off? Did I get it right?
Hannah smiles. Her day off has always been Wednesday. For all of the 9 years she's worked at Tall Tales, but for some reason her mother can never seem to remember that.
Yes, I'm in the park. How are you?
Her mother ignores the question.
I'm driving, so sorry if I cut out. I'm on hands-free. But are you okay? I felt worried after you rang off yesterday. I shouldn't have ambushed you at work.
No, it was fine.
Hannah watches a little girl evade her father and run gleefully into a huge muddy puddle at the foot of the slide.
You were right. It was better I heard it from you.
Did you get any trouble?
She means journalists, doorsteppers, cold callers, Hannah knows. In the early days, it was a swarm. When they came back to Dodsworth in those first few awful weeks after April's death, her mother had wooden shutters installed on the ground floor of their home so people couldn't peer through the curtains, and a brush on the inside of the letterbox. Hannah remembers them calling through the door.
"Any comment, Mrs. Jones? Is Hannah here? What would you like to say to John Neville if you met him?"
"Not really," she says now. "Just an email, nothing I couldn't handle."
"And how's Will?"
That's a more complicated question, and Hannah pauses. "How is Will?"
"I think he's okay," she says at last. "You know what he's like. He clams up whenever it comes up, but we talked about it a bit last night. I think he's just relieved it's over, mainly."
"He needs counselling,"
Hannah's mum says severely.
"You both do."
Hannah rolls her eyes. This is a discussion they've had before. In fact, she did have a few counselling sessions after the court case, and it helped in some ways. Gave her tools to deal with the panic attacks and unhealthy behavioural patterns. It was the counsellor who suggested the requests folder on her phone so she could mentally put the emails away until she was ready to move on from them. But she got everything useful out of the sessions and then got out. And Will? She certainly can't imagine Will sitting in some office talking about his feelings. "I know. We have talked about it. We're just a bit busy right now. You know, work, the baby. Will's working really long hours at the moment. He's barely ever home before 7.
"He should be looking after his pregnant wife,"
her mum says, and Hannah feels a rush of annoyance. "It's not his fault. He's hardly choosing to work 12-hour days. But there's a partnership position coming up. He needs to be seen to be putting in the hours if he's going to be in with the chance." And God knows they need the money before the baby comes, though she doesn't say that to her mother. Kathy is the nicest employer in the world, but the shop barely makes a profit. Hannah will be getting the statutory minimum maternity pay, and that's it. Kathy can't afford any more. And although Will has a reasonable salary, once they've paid their mortgage, there really isn't much left. If Will can make partner before she goes on leave, they will both breathe easier.
"I thought I'd come up in a couple of weeks,"
her mum is saying. Hannah can hear the tick-tock of the indicator over the car speakers.
"Help you out. Cook you both a few meals. Pfizer at work gave me some absolutely lovely maternity clothes. There's a really good coat. She said take what you want and charity shop the rest. I'll bring them up when I come."
"That sounds lovely," Hannah says. "I'll try to get a day off, maybe. What dates are you thinking?"
She waits for the answer, but it doesn't come. And when she looks down at the phone, the call has ended.
Great. Presumably, her mum has driven through a dead spot.
The rain has stopped, and she leaves the shelter of the yew tree and walks across to the gate to the playground, pulled, as if magnetised by the little group of kids and their parents. There's a strict limit to how long a lone adult can watch children playing, she's discovered. About 5 minutes before you start to get glances, maybe 10 before someone comes over and asks if you're looking for someone, though her growing belly gives her something of an alibi now. Women are more likely to smile sympathetically than glare suspiciously, and some will even start up a conversation. "Do you know what you're expecting?"
or when's the wee one due? Poor Will has no such leeway, though, and if they're out together, he pulls her past the park when she stops, lingering, trying to imagine her future here, Will's future. Now she watches a father pushing a little girl dutifully on a swing, rain still beading his hood, and she has a sharp, almost painful flash forward to a possible future. Herself, standing at this gate, watching Will, her husband, pushing their child in the same swing. She's standing there, holding her breath, trying to imagine her perfect future in this perfect life, with this perfect man, when her phone rings again. "Mum," she says, "we got cut off."
"Is that Hannah Jones?"
says a male voice.
"You don't know me. I'm a reporter with..."
Hannah almost drops her mobile. Then she stabs the end call button with a shaking finger and stands looking down at the phone in her hand. For the truth is this, and she will never escape it, her perfect life has come at a price. Mostly she thinks of herself as unbelievably lucky to be here in this beautiful city with the only man she has ever really loved. But now, with the reporter's voice ringing in her ears, she has a different feeling, that she is living a stolen life. Not just one she never deserved, but one that was never supposed to be hers. For what would have happened if April had not left the bar alone and gone up to their room to change? What would have happened if Hannah had followed her just 5 minutes earlier, discovered Neville in the room, interrupted the attack? Would she have ended up dead too? Or would April have been alive, living with Will, carrying his child? It starts to rain again as she shoves the phone into her pocket and begins to walk past the playground towards the road, with the children's cries following her as she goes. And she wonders. Maybe it wasn't only John Neville who stole April's life. Maybe she has done the same. Before. "Hannah Jones, I presume." The professor sitting in front of her swung round in his rotating chair and held out a hand. He was younger than Hannah had expected, with dark hair swept casually across his brow in a style that reminded her of someone, though she couldn't quite place who. Byron, perhaps, or a young Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Definitely a minor romantic poet. The white silk scarf tucked into his tweed jacket only added to the look.
"Dr. Horatio Myers, I will be taking you for Victorian literature this term, and then we will be covering some of the early 20th century material in Hillary and Trinity terms. Did you receive the reading list I sent through?"
"I did," Hannah said. It had been intimidating, to say the least, with a strong intimation that if she didn't at least start on the reading over the summer break, she was unlikely to keep up during term time. "Thanks," she added belatedly. "I'm sorry I'm late. I went to the wrong place."
"Ah."
Dr. Myers shuffled some papers in front of him and smiled at her.
"Stairwell 7, yes? Those are my rooms, and very nice rooms they are too, but rather small, so the college was kind enough to give me a separate office for tutorials. It's a little bit tucked away, I know."
"Just a bit," Hannah said with a laugh. She was still finding her way in the labyrinthine passages and back offices of Pelham. "I actually had to ask a porter for directions."
I hope he was helpful, Dr. Myers said dryly. The porters can be a little bit job's worth about that sort of thing.
Oh, no, he was very helpful, Hannah said. He brought me right here. To the door, in fact. I'm not sure I would have found it otherwise.
Good, good,
Dr. Myers said, though Hannah had the impression that he had moved on to other things.
Well, as you know, we'll be meeting weekly for these tutorial sessions alongside your lectures, and they will be a chance for us to really drill down into your understanding of the subject. You will normally have a tutorial partner, but I like to begin with a one-to-one to really allow us to get to know each other. Who are you, Hannah Jones? What do you want from Oxford? Tell me about the real you.
He leaned forwards towards her, steepling his fingers, looking at her seriously over the tops of his horn-rimmed glasses. Hannah was taken aback. Who was she? What did that mean? She already felt increasingly that she was a different person here from the one she had been at home. Different from the girl who sang unselfconsciously along with ABBA on the car journey up here with her mother. Different from the swotty student she had been at school in Dodsworth. Different even from the person who had walked through that stone archway on the very first day. Only deep inside herself was she the same, in the private, inner Hannah that she didn't show to anyone. The Hannah who rolled her eyes at April's excesses and secretly enjoyed films like Clueless and Legally Blonde. The Hannah who thought D.H. Lawrence was unreadable and pretentious. The Hannah who bit off her split ends and ate peanut butter out of the jar and did all of the myriad other strange and unadmirable things that people did in the privacy of their own company.
I'm not sure what you want to know, she said slowly. And then, as Dr. Myers only looked at her over his glasses,
I'm an only child. My parents are divorced, but amicably. I don't see my dad much at the moment. He lives in Norfolk with his new wife. My mum teaches A-level physics. I come from a town on the south coast called Dodsworth. You won't know it. It's a...
She gave a deprecating laugh, trying to find the right adjective for Dodsworth.
It's not a hellhole or anything. It's just really boring. It's got nothing going for it, really. No culture. Even the library closed down last year.
She stopped, trying to think of what else to say. What could she possibly tell him that he would be interested in? About her bog-standard comprehensive school with its used textbooks and peeling paint and total lack of any kind of character or history or record of academic excellence. Nothing about Dodsworth or her education there was likely to impress a man who had sat opposite students from the best private schools in the country. She felt again the crushing sense of imposter syndrome she had experienced when she first walked through the gate at Pelham for her interview, trying not to think of the thousands of other students who were applying for the same place as hers. 18-year-olds just like her, but ones who came from storied institutions and famous families, and who walked confidently into Pelham with the air of already belonging here, while she was still trying to convince herself of that fact even as she knocked on the door of the interview room. But, hard on the heels of that, came a flicker of something. Not anger, exactly, but something close. So what if she went to a state school? So what if Dodsworth had no culture and no history?
Didn't that make her leap to Oxford more impressive? She had been accepted here, after all, when many of those confident, shiny-haired students who had strode past her on the first day had not. She sat up straighter.
I was the only person in my year at school to apply for Oxford. I'm the first person in my family to come here, too. In fact, my dad doesn't even have a degree. He's a builder who left education when he was 16. I didn't volunteer to feed underprivileged kids in my gap year or spend my summer digging wells. I spent my summer working in a supermarket. As you may have guessed, I don't always feel like I fit in here, but I'm determined to prove I belong.
Dr. Myers said nothing for a long moment, but then he sat back in his chair and began clapping, slowly but steadily.
"Bravo, Hannah Jones," he said at last. "Bravo. I think we're going to get along very well, you and I. Very well indeed."
At the end of the hour-long tutorial, Hannah felt a strange mixture of drained and elated. Dr. Myers had taken her painstakingly back through her A-level syllabus and then got her to itemise the further reading she'd done in her own time, drawing out her opinions on everyone from Jane Austen to Benjamin Zephaniah. As the tutorial drew to a close, she had the sensation of having undergone a pummeling mental workout, as tiring as anything in the school gym.
"Until next week, then," Dr. Myers said with a smile. "And when you come back, I'd like you to give me 1,000 words on the role of social anxiety in any of these novels. Here's a list of books and essays you may find helpful on the reverse."
He handed her a piece of paper, and Hannah glanced down at it and then turned it over to read the other side. She had read all the novels cited, but none of the critical theory essays listed on the back of the page. She had no idea how she was supposed to find the time to do all of the further reading between now and next week, but she could worry about that later.
"Well, goodbye, Hannah Jones," Dr. Myers said. "Fare thee well, and we shall meet in a sennight."
Hannah nodded and turned for the door. When she let herself out into the corridor, the porter who had helped her find Dr. Myers's room was still there, leaning against a wall. It was the man she had met on her first day, not the grandfatherly one, the other, the one who had given her the keys.
"Got the right room this time?"
Hannah nodded, suppressing her puzzlement. Had he been outside for the whole tutorial?
Yes. Thanks. I don't think I would have found it without your help."
"All in a day's work."
His voice was just as off-kilter as it had been before, high and reedy in comparison to his stocky 6-foot frame. It sounded as though it belonged to a much smaller, frailer man.
"Where are you off to now, then?"
Hannah hadn't really thought about it. "I don't know. The library, I guess."
She glanced at the list of books Dr. Myers had handed her. The porter nodded.
"This way, then."
"Oh!"
Hannah flushed, realising that he intended to take her.
"No, I mean, I know where it is. Honestly, you don't need to walk me."
"Can't have the students getting lost on my watch,"
the porter said, and Hannah found herself flushing again, her cheeks hot. She felt annoyed, angry at her own stupid embarrassment, but also at this porter for being so weird and patronising and for not taking the hint that she didn't need his help.
Was he really going to accompany her all the way to the library? Why?
I don't need you to walk me, she said again. But the words sounded feeble and hollow, particularly as she had no choice but to follow him down the stairs from Dr. Myers's room, there being no other exit.
In the end, it seemed easier just to let him tag along, however strange she felt, being escorted across the quad and through the cloisters by a 50-something man in a porter's uniform. When they got to the door of the library, she said goodbye with some relief, silently vowing to leave by a different exit. Thank goodness there were several. Thank you. Honestly, you didn't have to.
My pleasure, the porter said.
He put out a hand.
John Neville. You need anything at all, you just ask for me.
Okay, Hannah said. She took his hand in spite of a twinge of reluctance. It was cold and soft and a little damp, like touching raw bread dough. Thanks. He held her grip just a little too long. When at last he let go, she tried to walk with dignity into the library rather than fleeing unceremoniously. But when she got up to the first floor, she could not stop herself going to a window overlooking the cloisters to check if he was still there. To her relief, he was not. He was walking away across the lawns back to the porter's lodge, and Hannah returned to the vaulted reading room with a sigh of relief. For the next few hours, she was kept busy, tracking down books and navigating the library's unfamiliar shelving system. But something about the encounter had shaken her, and as she sat down at the polished oak desk, the books piled up around her, it came back to her, the sensation of his cold, soft fingers on hers, and the sound of his reedy voice in her ears. She was being silly. He was probably just a lonely, middle-aged man with no talent for taking a graceful brush off. But one thing was for sure. She had absolutely no intention of asking John Neville for help ever again.